The Guardian. Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
This episode of Science Weekly is also brought to you by Get Into Teaching. Teaching is a career that allows you to make a real difference to young people's lives, and it's a great way to make your degree, skills, and knowledge really count. By sharing your passion for physics, chemistry, and biology with the next generation, you could get £25,000 tax-free to train, subject to availability, selected subjects only. To find out more, search Get Into Teaching and register for tailored advice to start your teaching career, or head to getintoteaching.education.gov.uk.
The shortlist for this year's Welcome Book Prize has just been announced. Now in its eighth year, the £30,000 prize aims to showcase fiction, non-fiction and memoir that engages with some aspect of biomedical science. This week we're looking at what makes a successful science book. Where do authors get their inspiration? How do they research their chosen subject? And what strategies do they have to turn complex scientific concepts into a riveting narrative?
Yeah, I was thinking about the storytelling because one of the things I'm interested in is what happens when the stories break, when the story that you find yourself in is not the one you thought you were in.
What makes science interesting is how it impacts people. And where it crosses with people, where that story breaks, as you mentioned, is on the human plane.
It really isn't just all about us. You know, we humans are just a tiny speck in the world, and we are incredibly dependent on and very deeply connected with all the other things that live around us and indeed inside us.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
David.
I spoke to three of the shortlisted authors, starting with Sarah Moss, who joins me in the studio this week.
You know, you've all written brilliant science books, and I'm sure you...
This is the third consecutive year that Sarah is in the running for the prize, and her latest book, The Tidal Zone, is one of two pieces of fiction featured in the shortlist. Sarah, your book, The Tidal Zone, focuses on the experience of a father whose daughter Miriam has suffered a cardiac arrest out of the blue. I'd be really interested in asking you how you came up with the plot line for this story.
I took medical advice. I was looking for a story that would really throw into relief the jeopardy in which most of us live unknowingly most of the time. And in fact, we all know that anybody could die at any moment for no particular reason, but I wanted an incident that would really force a family to confront that. So I talked to a friend who's a GP, and I kind of went to her with a set of symptoms requiring a diagnosis, and that was the one she suggested. Anaphylaxis is particularly interesting because it is caused by something, but sometimes you don't know what the thing is. So you just have to go through the world knowing that at any time you might meet this unknown substance that will cause you to die, could cause you to die. And you either retreat into a room and never go anywhere and live in fear, or you just accept that there's something in the world that's going to kill you and you get on with your life.
So this idea of some kind of jeopardy, was it always in the back of your mind that that was going to be a medical issue? Or was it when you were thinking about what would make a good plot device, you know, honed in on something medical?
The good thing about something medical is that it's abstract. I did think about a car accident or a terrorist incident. But the problem with both of those is that it's somebody's fault. And there's a politics. I mean, obviously you can't write about terrorism without writing about international politics. And while I might want to do that sometime, this wasn't the book in which I wanted to do it. And if it's a car accident, there's going to be an issue about guilt and blame and responsibility. And I wanted something that was utterly arbitrary.
And Miriam's mother is also an NHS doctor, I think. And it just made me wonder whether you've got a particular background, whether you've got family members who are doctors or friends, or whether it was just something that, you know, you were interested in exploring.
It fascinates me. My previous two books are also about doctors, although in the 19th century. I think I'm just really interested in mortality and in the idea of altruism and helping, but also in professionalism and ambition. And I think those things sit together so interestingly in medicine. And people sometimes say, why do you keep writing these books about medicine? But I don't think I'm writing books about medicine. I'm writing books about life and death and birth and mortality and fear. And in all of those moments, medicine is on hand, but it's actually the existential crises that interest me rather than who comes in a white coat and deals with it.
Could you just tell us a little bit about the medical condition, which it basically provides the dramatic tension for the whole story?
So Miriam has a condition called idiopathic exercise-induced anaphylaxis, which means that the combination of some substance that she's touching or more probably eating or drinking or maybe inhaling with exercise triggers a major anaphylactic response, which in this instance is very serious and very nearly kills her. And that was interesting to me because it's so arbitrary. I researched it by reading the medical journals, and one of the nice things about being a novelist who works in a university is that you have a research library on hand and nobody to know who's reading the medical journals or why. So for a little while, I probably knew more about it than most GPs do, but that goes away very quickly.
Do you have a bit of a nerdy side? Like, do you like getting into all the detail, every single detail of it, sort of beyond what you really need to know for the story?
You only know what you need to know for the story by knowing more than you need to know for the story. And I'm an academic by training, so I do a lot of research. Though usually having done the research, I don't look at it again. I mean, you know, I work with this notebook full of very detailed research notes on my desk, but I never look at them.
The last thing I wanted to ask about this was, there's been quite a few examples of contemporary novelists using science as a plot device or, you know, theme in the book. And I just wondered if you've got any favourites of recent books by other authors.
I absolutely loved Miriam Tove's All My Puny Sorrows, which was Wellcome shortlisted a couple of years ago. I don't think I really notice when there's science in a novel, because why wouldn't there be? I mean, we live with it and we enact it all the time. I don't think of it as a separate category from the rest of life.
Now to a book inspired by real-world events. David France's How to Survive a Plague is a powerful eyewitness account of the 1980s AIDS epidemic. It centres on how activists took on the scientific establishment to push for the approval of new drugs.
I have not eaten breakfast this morning.
David joined us down the line, and I started by asking him about the importance of the human stories in his work. David, I was really interested in whether your decision to write your book, How to Survive a Plague, was motivated by the human stories you'd come across while reporting on the AIDS epidemic.
Well, I began my reporting back in the early days of the epidemic, mostly focusing on science, but mostly doing it because I knew so many people who were sick. I am a gay man who moved to New York in the early 80s, and it was a time when, you know, we were all called upon to play some role in the epidemic, and I assigned myself the role of journalism to try and find and reveal any information that might exist that might be life-saving. But those were always personal stories for me, and they were always stories about, you know, people struggling to survive. And so the book really is the culmination of all those years of reporting.
David, is it something that while you were reporting on it at the time, you thought, one day I'm going to write a book about this? Or was it only afterwards that you could look back and see this overarching theme of the struggle of individuals pushing research science forwards that you really got the idea of putting it all together in one piece of work?
The thought came to me much later, actually. I began thinking about the project in 2008 or 2009 when it occurred to me that the canon of literature on the epidemic, on the plague, really ended before the advent of effective treatment. And much of it was written before the arrival of any single pill that, you know, even the ones that came early that didn't do any good. So they were, I mean, the books like And the Band Played On and stage plays and movies that really talked about the arrival of this mysterious new ailment, this virus that seemed to be selecting members of a marginalized community, but nothing about what the marginalized community did in order to counter that. Nothing about the way the community pulled together and rose up and changed the entire culture, really, of science and medicine and politics and civilization in really significant ways. And that part of the story, which is really a story of triumph and kind of an incredible human perseverance, had been left untold. And I felt a certain responsibility to go and try to pull that together and rescue that piece of history, you know, for future generations.
David, for people who haven't read your book, is there one individual story that you think represents a turning point in that struggle, or one story that you think perhaps gets across the kinds of contributions that people made?
The book opens at the very early blinks of the epidemic in 1981. And I didn't really activate as a journalist until 82, and wasn't seriously engaged in the science reporting until 83 and 84. So one of the discoveries that I found so remarkable was about how the very, very first people who were infected were engaged in a kind of a political activism around their infection. They saw the politics. They saw the reasons why the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, and bench science was not paying any attention to the epidemic. They saw the prejudice. They saw the hostility. And they began building the early foundations for this movement. And I'm thinking in particular of people like Michael Callan and Richard Berkowitz, both of whom were patients. They were among the first dozen or so people diagnosed with this immune disorder. They were probably, you know, patient number 30 and 35. And they immediately saw the political circumstances of their infection. They saw the hatred that was so kind of joyously embraced by the U.S. government and by the pharmaceutical industry about their disease, that was going to impact their ability to survive, and that it was doing a great disservice to science itself. And they took on the responsibility in those early days of writing about the politics of the epidemic. And they left behind this incredible body of audio tapes. They saw that the issue was not just that government celebrated the disease as, in one politician's words, divine retribution for a nasty vice, but that the media itself was playing a pernicious role in this, and they felt a need to record what was happening so that it could never be denied, even after their deaths. And that record was a phenomenal source of insight into those early years of the epidemic, but they carried it also out into a very personal sphere. Michael Callan met with his family who had disowned him and confronted them right before his death about their own culpability, really, in his death and in furthering this plague that started, as we remember, with a very small handful of people, 41 people sick in the first reports of the disease, and it has now expanded to 80 million people. And the tool, the fuel for that expansion, was this political, kind of obscene campaign to ignore what was happening.
From human history to the history and life of microbes. After this short break, we'll hear from our third and final author, Ed Yong.
I think it's a kind of magnificent idea. It's quirky, it's subversive, it means that all of the things we thought we knew about our biology take on this new and wondrous air. Things like the immune system, all of these things have a new character when you look at them through a microbial lens.
We'll also explore how these three very different tales intersect.
What makes science interesting is how it impacts people. And where it crosses with people, where that story breaks, as you mentioned, is on the human plane.
We'll be right back.
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Before we kick off this special episode of Science Weekly again, we wanted to let you know how you, one of our trusted listeners, can get your hands on the complete set of books from the 2017 Wellcome Book Prize shortlist. All you need to do is tell us on Twitter who won the 2016 Wellcome Book Prize, directing your tweets to @WellcomeBKPrize, that's Wellcome with two L's, with the hashtag ScienceWeekly. That's the winner of the 2016 Wellcome Book Prize to @WelcomeBKPrize with the hashtag ScienceWeekly. Winners will be announced and notified on Friday, so make sure to get your tweets out before then. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from two authors featured on the 2017 Wellcome Book Prize shortlist. Sarah Moss, author of The Tidal Zone, and David France, author of How to Survive a Plague.
Okay, so we're going to finish on the hour. I've got some questions prepared, but it would...
Ed Yong's I Contain Multitudes follows more of a traditional popular science book template, but his chosen subject matter is unusual.
I Contain Multitudes is probably the most traditional...
Ed joins us via Skype, and I started by asking him what first attracted him to the world of microbes.
So I've been writing about microbes and their influence on animal lives for about 10 years or so, and I actually think they're one of the most fascinating areas of modern biology. The idea that our lives and the lives of all the living things that we are familiar with and we can see are so profoundly influenced by all this life that we can't see, I think is a kind of magnificent idea. It's quirky, it's subversive, it means that all of the things we thought we knew about our biology take on this new and wondrous air. Things like the immune system, digestion, breastfeeding, evolution, all of these things have a new character when you look at them through a microbial lens. And really, microbes have been around for billions of years. They predate us by a significant margin. They are still the dominant forms of life on the planet. So I think if we don't bother understanding microbes, we don't really understand the world around us or indeed ourselves.
Was there a particular moment when you started seeing things from this microbes eye view? Because it's quite a disparate collection of stories that you tell in your book. It's not just about human biology. You're looking at, plants and animals and so on. When did you start kind of pulling all these together under the one common theme?
So over a long period of time, many of these stories I've been telling for the last 10 years or so, and I think that I wanted to write the book at the point when I realized that there are so many parallels between the way animals interact with their microbiomes, the communities of microbes in their bodies, and the way us humans do. So for example, there's a therapy that called a fecal transplant, which is a bit gross and is exactly what it sounds like, where doctors try and treat diseases by giving people the stool of someone who is healthy. And this has had tremendous impact to treating infections by a bacterium called C. diff, which causes severe cases of diarrhea. But that sort of transfer goes on in the animal kingdom all the time. Different species take up beneficial microbes from their peers and gain all kinds of health benefits. So there are insects that become instantly resistant to insecticides if they swallow the right detoxifying microbes. There are rats and mice that can become instantly resistant to toxins in plants around them, and so eat a much wider range of available foods. So I think the parallels tell us that microbes influence animal life in all these incredible ways that reach throughout the entire kingdom, throughout all the, you know, all the stuff you see on David Attenborough documentaries, and also into our own lives.
Ed, there's definitely a yuck factor to a lot of these microbe stories. I remember once trying to pitch a story about fecal transplants to a news editor when it was first a thing, and he just looked at me as though I was some kind of pervert. I'm just really curious about how people react to this topic, and whether, you know, what people say when you tell them what you're writing about, and whether you think that the whole yuck factor is actually a way of engaging people because you get this visceral reaction.
So there is definitely a yuck factor, and there's a bit of a PR battle to fight, because microbes for the longest time have been viewed as enemies and as antagonists. You know, we associate them with disease and dirt. There are so many terrible news stories about people swabbing surfaces, finding bacteria on them, and then immediately assuming that those surfaces are dirty. But the very essence of the book is to fight against that perspective, and to show that not only are microbes not necessarily signs of dirt or disease, but they are actually critically important to us. The vast majority of them are either benign or beneficial, and they play intricate and almost inextricable roles in our lives. You know, many animals wouldn't be able to survive without the microbes that they carry. A lot of this has been about rehabilitating the image of microbes. And I've generally found that people are very receptive to that idea. Like, we like plot twists in our stories. We like rooting for underdogs. And the story of the microbiome is very much about both of those things, about taking something that people had this negative reaction to and showing that actually it's a really positive and important part of our existence.
I think it's really interesting what you say about the idea of rooting for the underdog and the underdog being the microbe. Do you think that in general science itself can be the sort of fill that character role in a story, or do you think that it helps to have personalities, say, you know, interesting scientists who you tell the story through?
Oh, for sure. I mean, this I feel the science is fascinating in itself, but there are also really interesting people in this field and in the book. You know, I spend a lot of time talking about the people who've done this research, often working on the fringes of their fields, often, you know, standing up against established wisdom and slowly working their way to now being in the very center of biology. And I think that's important because you know, microbes by their very nature are hard to see. They are easy to ignore, and they're easy to fear and to loathe. And I think the way you get people interested in microbes is by getting people interested in people who are interested in microbes. And there are plenty of them. They have great stories to tell, and they're a bunch of very passionate, sometimes eccentric, very interesting characters.
To me, these are three very different examples of science writing, but I wondered whether the same kind of person would be attracted to reading all three books.
I mean, maybe it's the science, but I also think that it sounds like the thing that really unites the books is the telling of stories. And I think that's a universal trait that applies to all of humanity. I think people are fundamentally interested in hearing stories and narratives about other things, whatever those things might be. And I think that it sounds like all three of those books have that in spades.
Yeah, I was thinking about the storytelling, because one of the things I'm interested in is what happens when the stories break, when the story that you find yourself in is not the one you thought you were in, or even when you think you're in a story and you find that there is no narrative, because that's what happens immediately to Adam and Miriam in the aftermath of her cardiac arrest. They think they're in a story about a middle-class family living an ordinary life with normal kinds of concerns. And then they find themselves in the resuscitation room, and then they find that there's no way forward, that they don't know what's going to happen, and nobody else knows what's going to happen either. So, I mean, I think to go back to your original question, yes, I think the same readers would read all of these books, because I think people who like intelligent books like a very wide range of intelligent books and read very widely. But in some ways, maybe actually the nonfiction science tells more of a story or is more comfortable with its stories than the fictional approaches, because fiction is usually about the breaking as well as the making of stories.
Well, I guess my first thought is that that what makes science interesting is how it impacts people. And where it crosses with people, where that story breaks, as you mentioned, is on the human plane. And I think we've all cast our stories as human stories. And that is, I think that's the way science is consumed, certainly by the readers of the popular press, and consumed and understood as a real central core of life itself. And in that regard, I think that all three of our books certainly kind of capture that the human impact of disease and the response to it, and that makes them all very similar in that way.
So I just wanted to sort of add and maybe push back on this idea a little bit, because I think so I Contain Multitudes is a book that features a lot of stories of people, and it is partly about people, but it isn't only about that. Like, I specifically didn't want to write a book that was only about the human microbiome or about humans. Like, in its essence, I Contain Multitudes is a natural history book. I wanted to go beyond people and to look at the wider world around us, both at the animal kingdom and the microbial world. And I think science is sort of uniquely positioned to be able to do something like that, you know, more than a lot of other aspects of, you know, human endeavor. It takes us out of ourselves. It shows us the rest of the world beyond our own boundaries and interests. And it talks about things that aren't necessarily all about us. And, one of the core points about the book, I think, is that it really isn't just all about us. You know, we humans are just a tiny speck in the world, and we are incredibly dependent on and very deeply connected with all the other things that live around us and indeed inside us. And it's that kind of grander perspective of ourselves as only part of this gigantic ecosystem of life that I wanted to convey.
Special thanks this week to Sarah Moss, David France, and Ed Young. We'll include links to all three of the books in the episode's description on the Guardian website. We'll also include a link to the Wellcome Prize website, where you can see all the titles on both the short and long list from this year's prize. Again, if you want to get your hands on all five shortlisted books, tell us who won the 2016 prize, directing your answers on Twitter to @WelcomeBKPrize, that's Welcome with two L's, with the hashtag Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin, this is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.